Conversations with the most brilliant authors and personalities in the Bitcoin space. This is a Bitcoin Audible chat. What is up, everybody? This is Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I have got a conversation today, one that is long overdue. The amazing author of Inventing Bitcoin and CTO and co-founder of Swan Bitcoin, actually, and a good friend, to be honest. Jan is just a really, really awesome guy, and it's been incredible getting to know him. And we kind of discussed when I did his audiobook, when we started it ages ago, we had talked over and over again about like, oh, we need to get on the show. We need to sit down and really have a chat, and hadn't gotten to it. And it was overdue. You know, it was just time to do it. So, I think you guys are going to love this conversation. I had so much fun, and, without further ado, let's just go ahead and jump in to our chat with Jan Pritzker. Jan Pritzker on Bitcoin Audible, for the listeners. First, this welcome to the show, man.
Thanks so much, Guy. Thanks for having me.
This is long overdue. Indeed. Honestly, you author of Inventing Bitcoin, audiobook by yours truly. Very honored to be that.
And appreciate your work on that audiobook. It's fantastic.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you write another one, I'm right there. Just hit me up. co-founder and CTO of Swan Bitcoin and Give Bitcoin, and Bitcoiner extraordinaire. It's really good to have you.
Thanks, Guy. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. Just for general introductions, why don't you just start with your background, the easy stuff? How'd you get into Bitcoin? What were you doing beforehand? Because you actually have a really interesting backstory. I was actually like really caught into that. That was what sold me on the book immediately. I was reading that first chapter and I was like, oh shit, this is great. I really kind of love that story. Why don't you give the audience, anybody who doesn't know, that
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I have I think, you know, not to kind of put the focus on my story being very special, because I think everybody coming to Bitcoin has a very special story, because it's so interesting how Bitcoin attracts people for all kinds of different reasons, and they all find something in their own life that ties back to it, that draws them to it. And so for me, it was a combination of factors. I heard about Bitcoin a number of times, starting from way back in 2011, and of course, did not research it, did not understand it, did not fall down the rabbit hole. I did buy some, though, in 2011 at the very top at $30. And then, and then it went down to two. And that was my first Bitcoin wreckage that I experienced. And it was brutal. And I basically, you know, I didn't understand investing. I didn't understand markets. I didn't understand what Bitcoin was. So I basically wrote it off, sold the bottom, and got out of there. And then saw it again in 2013 and basically, you know, again, bought some, but again, didn't really research it, didn't actually devote my time. So it took me a while. And it wasn't really until 2016 that I finally kind of got caught the Bitcoin bug and started falling down the rabbit hole. And actually, I have to thank Andreas Antonopoulos for that. His videos back in 2016 were really great and finally made me understand the purpose of Bitcoin as a freedom money, which is really the angle that I come at it from, is how Bitcoin can be a tool and a force for good in the world by helping people have real ownership over their money that's not going to be confiscated by some authoritarian government. It's not going to be, you know, stolen from them through inflation or through capital controls. And the reason that resonated for me, and to step back, you know, my history is as a technologist. I've been building startups, you know, for 20 years. Ever since, you know, I was a kid, I was involved in programming and learning to code on my computer and building startups for a long time. So when I saw Bitcoin, I saw a technology, right? I saw a very cool distributed technology. I heard about this, you know, blockchain word, and I started researching all these blockchain projects, right? And looked at Ethereum and looked at all these other cryptos. And it was really blown away by all this kind of action in the ecosystem. And it probably took me a good year of sorting through all of that before I started to understand Bitcoin as money, which totally trumps all other considerations in this space, I would say. And once you understand how money works, you start to understand why Bitcoin is so important and why these other things aren't necessarily money. And that was what really brought me back to Bitcoin. And what I started understanding was, you know, that the Bitcoin was a tool to help people escape essentially like authoritarian regimes and capital controls. And once I understood that, I actually started thinking about how, like where I came from. You know, I actually immigrated from the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, 1989, with my parents, and we came to America with, you know, very little. We didn't have any money really, and we started from scratch. And I never really thought about it. You know, I just kind of assumed that everybody, you know, who leaves a country escaping, you know, a horrible environment, just comes in poor and starts from scratch in America. This is just kind of the American dream, right? You build up your life. But as it turns out, we had money. We just weren't able to take it out of the country. So when we left the Soviet Union, the government was allowing us to exchange $100 per person from Soviet rubles, which are toilet paper currency, like Venezuelan currency is today. They were exchanging it, you know, at the government official rate, which is not the real rate. So they gave us $100 worth and sent us on our way. And that's, you know, I literally found this out like when I was 35 years old. I didn't think about this my whole life. And once I got into Bitcoin, I started thinking about this and asking my parents. And they told me the story about how we left the Soviet Union and how they didn't let us keep our money. And I was like, oh, now I understand the real purpose of Bitcoin, right? This is not like, it's not a get rich quick thing. It's not a fancy technology thing, even though it is a very interesting technological achievement. What it is, it's a money that you can actually take with you when you leave a country, which is, holy crap, how powerful is that as a force for freedom in the world?
From a historical perspective, it's unprecedented, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How old were you when that happened?
Yeah, I was 7 years old when I came. And this is part of the reason why I never thought about it, right? I grew up as a kid, normal kid in America. You know, I got my first computer when I was like 8 years old. So as soon as I came over, my dad saved up enough money, bought me a computer. I learned to code. I went to school. I got into startups. Never thought about my history as a, you know, as a former Soviet citizen.
And when you're seven, that's just the world, you know?
Yeah, it's like, whatever. Yeah, I mean, I had a normal childhood. It's like people don't, you know, if you live in a country like that, you don't really know what the outside looks like. You know, we had bread lines and we had shortages of goods, but like, this is just, that was life. So you didn't know that it was different anywhere else.
That's so crazy. So when you said you've been doing startups for like 20 years, what's kind of, what was that journey like? I'm kind of really only committing to doing my own thing really since Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But what's your background there?
I grew up coding and I went to school for computer science and linguistics. And I was thinking about like working in machine translation and AI. That was kind of something I was passionate about when I was a kid. But when I got out of college, I fell into a few startups kind of by accident. Like my dad got me a job while I was still in college as an intern at a startup that he was working at. And it was an online university. It wasn't anything I was specifically passionate about. But when I got there, the energy was just so high. Like people were so interested in building this thing and they thought they were creating the future and people were like sleeping under their desks. And, you know, it was just like, it was the dot-com time period. So we had all the excesses of the dot-com era. Like we had, you know, free food in the office and we had like, everybody had toys. We had like $500 like gas-powered like racing cars and stuff like that. Like just crazy stuff was going on. And just felt, you know, as a kid, and I was, you know, say 18, 19 years old, coming into an environment like that, it was just like, wow, this is really cool and really fun. And once I started working there, I really just became excited about being a part of a startup. And I decided pretty much within my first year of that experience that I didn't ever want to work for a big company. I wanted to always be involved at the ground floor of something, building something with a passion. And I started basically hopping from startup to startup, either as an early employee or a co-founder, ran my own startup for a little bit. And, you know, those things kind of, probably every 2 or 3 years, I would try something new. It was kind of a very exciting time. And, you know, throughout my 1 year career in the space, I did like 6 different startups. At one point, I did 2 simultaneously. So I had a full-time job as the first employee and had my own startup on the side. So yeah, that was pretty intense. And it kind of culminated, I think, in my biggest success. You know, to be clear, startups, you know, they have a very low success rate. I think everybody knows that about startups. Mm-hmm. It's mostly like a crapshoot. You try stuff, you fail for a lot of different reasons. Sometimes reasons under your control. Sometimes, you know, if you get sued by a big company trying to put you out of business, which happened to one of my companies, like stuff like that. Yeah. We were doing this airline reservation system, and like Orbitz tried to come after us. Their parent company tried to come after us using Orbitz, who were previously friends of ours. So stuff like that happens, you know. It's like
dirty business.
Yeah, it's dirty business, you know. You know, sometimes you fail because you don't have product market fit. Had a cloud computing startup, you know, in like 2006 before cloud was even a thing. And we were just too early. Probably like if we had started 5 years later, we would have been in the sweet spot. But sometimes you build the right thing at the wrong time, which is what happened there. It wasn't really until 2012 that I finally kind of hit the jackpot and getting the right idea at the right time with the right team and the right execution, which was Reverb. And we spent, you know, Reverb was a marketplace for musicians, kind of like an Etsy for guitars and drums and stuff like that. And we built that out. The founder was David Kalt, who had a bunch of different exits prior to that and had, you know, was really smart and on the business side. And I came in as a CTO to help build that out. And by 2018, we had built it into 150 people doing like $500 million in sales. So it was quite an achievement. And at that point, that's when I decided that, you know, I couldn't do Bitcoin and that at the same time. So I had to dive down the rabbit hole.
Nice. So you just kind of left that for Bitcoin? Like, did you have anything specific in mind, or were you just like, I just gotta figure out something with Bitcoin. Let's just go all in.
Yeah. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had been studying Bitcoin since 2016, pretty extensively. Like I would say, you know, 3 to 4 hours a day, pretty much like on pods, you know, you videos, articles, books. And,
I know I felt, what that's like, I do. Right?
Yeah. I think people know you get red pilled to a certain point where you're like, there's nothing more important in the world to be working on than Bitcoin. Like literally there's nothing more important that I could be doing with my skills than helping Bitcoin succeed. But I didn't know what I was going to do. So in 2018, it was right after that massive run-up in price and somewhat kind of like on the tail end of that, being kind of really like euphoric from that rise, I said, okay, I believe in Bitcoin. Like, I think it's proven itself to me a few times now. I've lived through several bear markets. I know what this looks like. And I'm ready to take the plunge. But yeah, I didn't know what I was going to do. But given that my background was as a developer, as a CTO, as a product person, I kind of decided I was going to go out and find some startups that needed help and consult. And at first, I kind of did a little bit of Bitcoin-related startups and a little bit of random other startups. But then over time, I basically started focusing more and more on helping Bitcoin-related companies in the space. And I actually spent a year on the infrastructure side with a company called Bloxroute, which is a multi-coin company. It's a company. Ooh, yeah. I have my dirty past.
Dirty hands.
So Bloxroute is actually a really cool idea. They're like a base layer scaling technology. So the idea is that basically instead of miners passing blocks to each other, they would route them through a special system, which is the Bloxroute distribution network. It's kind of like similar to a CDN where, you know, they basically compress the blocks and they do all this kind of stuff that's similar to fiber for Bitcoin.
I was about to say, so kind of like fiber.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like the Matt Corral thing, but it's universalized. It's across all blockchains. And the theory is like, you know, all blockchains don't scale. This is known. And this is actually where I learned that blockchains don't scale really well, because these guys were like, there's no amount of scaling that will fix a blockchain. Like, there's no amount of increasing the block size that will fix it, because at some point it will just unravel. Like, it won't be able to sync. And it doesn't matter if it breaks at 10x the current size or 100x or 1000x, it will break. Yeah. And these guys have done all the research. There's a bunch of Cornell and Northwestern PhD people, and pretty much proved to me by working there that blockchains don't scale, which I was thankful for that knowledge. You know, their solution was, okay, they don't scale, but we can introduce this kind of centralized system to help them scale, which is you know, fine, but it's not fine for, if you're trying to just, it's not fine for Bitcoin, because Bitcoin can't have any centralization. So that was, you know, working there is when I got more and more convinced around the blockchain scalability problem, why the big block debate was totally ridiculous, and why Bitcoin was never going to adopt something like that and not never going to have any kind of centralization. And coming out of that, I really understood that Bitcoin was money, and that maintaining its immutability above all was the most important thing. And so that's kind of when I started writing the book. I started writing the book about Bitcoin because I was, you know, I was telling people about Bitcoin all day, every day, and I wanted to give something to them that they could take home. And
This was after you were working with that company.
I was kind of doing it simultaneously. I think after I'd left Reverb, I started, I don't remember exactly the timeline, but I started giving talks at high schools, and those talks were starting to become the foundation of the book. And I was writing the book while I was working there, and then kind of published it. I wasn't an employee, I was a consultant, but you know, I was devoting probably a good half of my time to them. It was a pretty intense thing.
That's a really interesting perspective to have on it too. Like work with a company that tried to get around the obvious fact, and like people who really dug into it. It's like, yeah, this doesn't scale, but we could provide a solution as a service.
Right.
This, like, to kind of have that.
They recognize that. And it's interesting because they, you know, they recognize that they're a centralizing force, and they try to do all kinds of things to kind of avoid that. Like, for example, they have, you know, they encrypt everything so they can't censor traffic and all this kind of stuff. They try to take steps to not be a central player, but at the end of the day, like, you are sending your blocks to a network run by a company, right? So
yeah.
And they're going to have a way to like run backup networks and all this kind of stuff. But this is the problem with all these solutions, is that at the end of the day, there is still some central actor. And there's probably a world where, you know, three or four companies get together and want to share a database and they want to use something like this. And that's fine. I don't think that's the same thing as having money, which is Bitcoin, which cannot have any amount of centralization. So that's when I kind of decided, you know, I want to work on Bitcoin exclusively. This is not the right thing for me to be doing. I need to figure out what that is. And basically left and started being more of a Bitcoin educator and just talking to people and helping them understand Bitcoin.
Dude, that's so interesting too, that like, because that's absolutely just the way you brought that up the first time, is that like, you know, from a technology perspective, is like, oh, well, this is an interesting technology. Look at all of these other blockchains. Okay, like, they do some things and Bitcoin does things. This is great. What a fascinating system, you know, the proof of work, consensus, all that. But then, oh my God, it's money. And then you start going down the rabbit hole of what money is. Mm-hmm. And then it's immediately you begin to realize the vast difference between these two things. And I find it that so many people, particularly in, you know, quote unquote crypto, never cross the barrier into money, into understanding it from the monetary aspect. They see it as a technology. And it's fascinating that those two things really are not at all like each other. They're not the same thing.
I agree. There's a very common fallacy around when technologists approach Bitcoin and they look at it as a technology, then it's like, well, where's version two? Where's version three? Where's the next Bitcoin? That's all technology people ask that question. And that's what, I mean, including myself, right? When I got into Bitcoin, I didn't look at Bitcoin first, even though I knew about Bitcoin from 2011. I looked at Ethereum, because it had really good marketing. Like, the homepage was beautiful, and they showed you how you could build a bank.
The homepage was beautiful.
It was beautiful. I mean, seriously, like, there's one thing they got right, which is their marketing, and their marketing to developers specifically was extraordinarily good. You know, when you're a developer and you hear that you can build a bank in 100 lines of code, this is revolutionary. It really is, because this is the kind of stuff that people spend years building. It's very, very hard to build distributed systems. So here you have this platform where you can build your own coin, your own bank, and it's like 100 lines of code. It's really kind of crazy. So, you know, I was interested in that, and I looked at that, and I even wrote Solidity code to try to see what, you know, the state of the union was there, like, how are things working? I learned all this stuff, and it's cool as a prototyping platform. It's cool. But like, then you realize, oh, wait a minute, but there's also this other thing, which is the ETH token, which is like supposed to be money. And then you're going down the money rabbit hole, because if you understand how money works, you see that that's not going to happen in the presence of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
You're not going to have these two free market monies coexisting. So, you know, but you can get very much down the path of like, where's the next Bitcoin? And the marketing of a lot of these ICOs and altcoins is very good. It's like, we're faster, we're more private, we have this feature, we have, you know, these fancy sounding cryptographic terms, like, you've never heard of ZK snarks. Well, we have them, and Bitcoin doesn't. So like, you know, this is better.
Our snarks,
right?
Are so much better.
We have snarks, we have snarks. We've got like the hottest research out of, you know, MIT being implemented. And the thing is, there's nothing wrong with research, and there's nothing wrong with trying new ideas. The problem is when you start to sell these things as money, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're trying to compete with something like Bitcoin, which is, you know, the hardest, most decentralized, most immutable money on the planet. It's not going to happen. And I think a lot of technologists miss that.
It's funny too, because like technology, like when you look at it from a technology perspective, you're expecting iterations to happen on a much, much faster level. I mean, just like you said, like you're looking for Bitcoin 2.0 or the third iteration of this thing. You know, like after the iPhone comes out, you know, 4 years down the road, you're like, okay, well, what's the next breakthrough? Or is the iPad, you know?
Right.
But as soon as you step back and you look at it as money, you're like, yeah, the scale changes drastically immediately.
And the impact, like the,
somebody
said, I don't remember who said this, but they said that like writing blockchain code is more like writing code for rocket shuttles. Like you send it into space and you cannot modify the code once it's in space, right? It's like, it better work. It better be bug free. It better have no issues, because like people's lives are at risk. And this is the thing with money, is like, if this is actually money, I mean, imagine, you know, we're using Bitcoin on a day-to-day basis as our standard money. And all of a sudden somebody like, you know, clicks a button to upgrade it. And then like everything and the shit hits the fan, right? And like money is broken. Imagine that. Like, are you kidding me? You can't have that. So it's a completely different design consideration. And as somebody who comes, you know, I come from web apps and, you know, I'm very used to moving quickly and breaking things. And you see that ethos in like other blockchains, right? Like Ethereum. Oh, we made this small bug to the inflation. No big deal. Here's a patch. Let's click this button. Like, you know, like you can't do that. And you can't do that if you're trying to build something that's money. And so you can't move fast and break things, and you can't have a very large surface area for security bugs, and you can't have general purpose languages that have, you know what we say, like Turing complete means that the language can do anything. And this is the case with a lot of these blockchain projects where they're like, oh, our language is Turing complete. You could do whatever you want with it. Well, that's a bad, not a feature. That is not a feature when it comes to money. You want to be able to analyze it and know that it's going to work.
Yeah, you want to know exactly your list of attack vectors.
Yes.
And exactly how big those gaps are. I can't remember who it was. I'm sure it's multiple people, but referred to it as Turing vulnerable.
as opposed to Turing complete. And I think it's really interesting that Satoshi kind of recognized these things early on. You see him disabling certain opcodes because he was concerned about, you know, the surface area of attack and, you know, basically unknown behavior. Whereas other blockchains, and, you know, you have Bitcoin forks that have said, oh, we're just going to turn all these things back on because they're going to be, you know, we're going to have a more powerful way of doing computation.
Yeah.
But dude, you're not trying to do powerful computation. This is money. And this is the problem. That's not what we're building here.
You're trying to build a base layer that, you know, if the system is going to be $10 trillion in value, it has to be sustainable against a $1 trillion attack.
Exactly.
You know, like it can't be, there can be no question, no tiny hairline cracks, anything in the foundation of this. Like, we're talking about building a new world on top
Absolutely.
Of it.
It's a huge undertaking. And the fact that it's being done in an open source way is really revolutionary. And there's people all over the world, you know, looking at it and contributing to it. And this is really amazing. But we have to remember that even though it looks like software, it's probably the most critical software project on the planet. You know, more critical than a space shuttle, because a space shuttle explodes, it kills the people inside of it. Bitcoin explodes, it messes up our whole money system, right? If this is the future of money, it, like killing global trade with one, you know, with one bug, you can't do that. And so I think that
open platform that anybody can join, like the risks there. Yeah.
But the interesting thing is about Bitcoin is that it's so strong. Its immune system is so strong, right? And the fact that it doesn't do these things, you know, other chains, they do hard forks, right? They kind of like, the hard forks essentially mean, oh, we're just going to get everybody who runs this thing to agree to upgrade. That's essentially what it means. And so like, imagine that, right? Imagine, you know, Bitcoin is adopted by, you know, millions of people worldwide. And all of a sudden we're like, okay, tomorrow, everybody update your software or it breaks. You can't do that. It's like, okay, tomorrow, everybody take all the cash out of your wallet, run to the bank and exchange it for the new cash that's coming out, which countries have done. And you know, people have gotten screwed in that process more often than not. You can't do that when you're talking about money. There's not going to be like, replace this with this other coin thing. That's not how it's going to happen. You're going to have a layered approach. You can build other services on top of Bitcoin that do other things and, you know, settle value in different ways. But you're not going to be like exchanging all of your Bitcoin for Bitcoin shitcoin tomorrow. It's not going to happen.
Bit shitcoin.
Bit shitcoin 3.0.
It is really funny that how drastic that shift is between a technology and a money. And like the technology becomes the derivative, where I think that's the difference in the two perspectives is that like there's the technology comes first and then look, we can use it as money versus the money comes first. How do we make the technology serve that?
Yeah, I thought this way when I got into Bitcoin. I literally bought this idea that the blockchain was the invention and Bitcoin was the first application. I even wrote a blog post about it, which I haven't taken down because I'm proud of, you know, I had a different line of reasoning and I've changed it, right? Bitcoin was the first application for blockchain. This is something I heard from Andreas and there will be other applications. And I totally bought into the idea we're going to have blockchain voting and blockchain democracy and blockchain this and that. And then as I researched it more and more and I realized like, no, these things are all gameable. The whole point of Bitcoin is that it's an isolated system. The Bitcoin itself is the bearer asset and it's the thing that drives the incentive structure of the whole system. Once you have external, you know, you interact with external world, you can't implement these other ideas because things like identity creep in and you can't have identity in Bitcoin. It's not going to work that way.
Yeah. In fact, it's kind of antithetical to that. It's kind of the whole point is that you don't attach identity to it. Of course, at the same time, there was kind of a hint of identity in the fact that you can create your own, like your public key is just your verification. So,
yeah, of course, you can create your own identities. But the point is, like, for example, for a voting scheme, if you can create your own identities, then you have a problem with a Sybil attack, right? I can create a million identities. Yeah. So that's the kind of genius of Bitcoin with proof of work is that that's the Sybil mechanism. It's preventing somebody from faking that they, you know, that they actually burn the electricity, like they have to burn it. So that's the interesting thing about Bitcoin, but pretty much all these other ideas that are like supply chain for blockchain or, you know, democracy for blockchain, like all of these things that rely on external truth leaking into the blockchain, which is very, very hard to keep true. There's no incentive structure keeping those things aligned.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of that's the thing about like, you know, trying to use a blockchain for healthcare records and all of this stuff is that like, the beauty of Bitcoin is that everything involved in the incentive structure, in the accounting, like in the actual record keeping of the system is internal to the system. Mm-hmm. Like all of the actual Bitcoins were created within the rules of Bitcoin. So like there's no human input, you know, the machine system is the input.
Yeah. And I think I think what will happen is the idea of the blockchain really woke up a lot of corporations to the idea that they can have timestamped hashed databases that they could potentially share with other companies. That's fine. Yeah. I mean, that idea has been around for decades. Yeah. If Bitcoin was a thing that made them aware of that, it was great. But that's not the same thing, right? And I think that a lot of times we conflate the idea that, okay, you know, you can host a database on IBM or AWS or Microsoft and call it a blockchain and have three companies writing to it. If you want to call that a blockchain, then and that helps you wrap that concept up in the word, that's fine. But I don't think it's the same thing as Bitcoin. And people don't recognize it. It doesn't solve the same set of problems.
Yeah. Technically, they could have done that in the 80s when Merkle trees, you know, came about.
Right,
and
these
stuff.
Things have been around. I mean, fair, like a lot of the pieces are now more available, right? Like cloud services are now more available. Mm-hmm. And I was there when the word cloud was invented, like 2005, 2006. And everybody started plastering that word on every single thing until it meant nothing, right? Because what does cloud mean today? Cloud means internet, right? Like
server.
Somebody else's server. But in 2005, it was actually a revolution. The revolution wasn't somebody else's server. It was that you could get resources on demand. That's the revolution of cloud. Mm-hmm. And so if the revolution of blockchain is that you can share data and timestamp it, like, great. I mean, yes, that revolution happened 20 years ago. But if all the pieces are there and people want to use it, fine. But it's not Bitcoin. Bitcoin is about scarcity. It's about digital scarcity, which is not what any of these other projects provide.
Yeah. And their biggest downfall is that they think they're going to create, that they need a consensus token for a lot of these things, you know, like no, you're just sharing a database of information to try to create, you know, some source of, you know, chronology to work off of, but you don't, you're not going to be able to do this with like a money. You can't create your own money and a utility token. Like you're shooting yourself in the foot for any value that you could get out of it.
And I think to be fair to the smarter companies, like the actual corporations in the space, they're not doing stuff with tokens. When they say blockchain, they literally mean like they're firing something up on AWS and they're sharing a database. Whereas you have these ICOs, which like they needed to sell something. So now they have to figure out how to integrate that something that they sold into their system and pretend like there's an incentive structure around it, which is a totally different thing. And this is, you know, I tweeted about this probably a year ago where I said people are trying to do startups, but inadvertently they're creating money, right? Like if you're an ICO, you're basically trying to do a startup and it's like a normal startup. You're trying to do, you know, supply chain, whatever. And then all of a sudden you also have this token that you sold to investors and you're trying to tell them this token is going to be part of your ecosystem. Well, what you did is you created money and your money is in direct competition with Bitcoin. So what's going to happen when somebody gets this token? You know, if you pay people in this token, what are they going to do? They're going to sell it and dump it for what is actually money, which is Bitcoin. Yep. And so what does that do to the value of your token over time? Drives it to zero. Nobody wants to hold these things. So of course, it doesn't make any sense. It does not make sense to use tokens as as an incentive structure when this is like a hosted database. So, you know, people are going to take a long time learning that lesson, I think.
Yeah. And even if they built some sort of a product or useful network out of it, it's not stock. You know, like it's not like a share in that network. Like they're just trying to, I can't remember what it was, but there was some project not too long ago that had, that tried to make their coin, like the utility token, which is, you know, the story of almost all of these. And then, somebody just copied it and did it without the token.
I think they're trying to, aren't they trying to do that to Brave? I heard that like, cause the Brave had that bat token and they're trying to do like a lightning version of Brave, I think.
Oh, that's funny.
I heard somewhere that somebody was looking at forking Brave to do Lightning, which is honestly what I think is going to be the future of all these things. Like, if the project makes sense, great. But if it needs money, there's only one money. That's Bitcoin. Yeah. So use the Bitcoin. Now, look, to be fair, Bitcoin isn't good for, you know, if Bitcoin's on-chain transaction fees are very high, then obviously you can't do micropayments with it. Obviously, right? And so... then people are like, okay, well, if I can't do micropayments and Lightning Network isn't really there where I need it to be, well, I'm going to invent my own token. But then the problem is that token, like let's say you have this Ethereum token and it's only as good so far until there's a CryptoKitties that clogs up the whole network. And then they have the same problem, right? As we said, all blockchains don't scale. The only reason they look like they're scaling is nobody using them. So once somebody tries to use them, they don't scale. So you have the same problem. You can jump from blockchain to blockchain. And we have I just heard the news about Kin, which is another, it's like a messaging product. They try to have their own token and they started like on Ethereum. Then they went to Stellar. Then they went to like Orbs. Then they went to like some other thing. So they just keep jumping blockchains because it's the same problem. This one didn't scale. So we're going to try this other one. Dude, none of them scale. Newsflash. Yeah. None of them scale. This is just, you're just jumping to one that's not used. And if that's your business model, then like, all right. But, but the thing is that, you know, what you're giving people, if you're going to pay somebody out in the token and they don't want to hold that token, you have a real incentive problem. It doesn't matter how fancy you get with your incentive structures in your own project, because they always have the option of trading that token against Bitcoin. That's the fundamental issue. Bitcoin is in the room and it's not leaving.
Yeah. So, and that's one of those things that like just kind of observing that this is like how these projects, like just kind of like, you know, stop and look at the big picture. Like if these projects are hopping chains, then there's nothing inherent about the token or the network itself that's needed to make these things work. Like by necessity, they're hopping chains. Like you can't have Bitcoin just hop over to Ethereum, you know, like the system that makes it work. You can't just like put it on a different server and have it, you know, like migrate it. Like it just is or it isn't, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, again, they're looking, essentially what they found with these blockchains is like, it's like free hosting, right? So, oh, I can get free hosting on BSV. Awesome. Free hosting on BSV is great. I don't have to pay for hosting. And I'm going to do it until I clog it up. Then I'm going to go to another chain and clog that one up. Like, I'm just going to keep doing it until the miners, you know, and if the miners of those systems are incentivized to keep mining, then it keeps functioning to some degree, even if it's like minuscule, right? Even if it's just pennies, but it works. So, you know, to some degree, it's like, I believe that Bitcoin is the only, you know, money in the space. But can all these other things coexist for decades? Like, probably, you know, as long as there's some minuscule amount of usage, it might be worth for somebody to run three servers and mine this thing. And like a lot of these things, they don't care. I mean, if they're using it as a database and they just want it to be on three servers, then that's what it's going to be.
We'll see. It'll be, I'm real curious. Do you think there's going to be another hype cycle of that? Like of altcoins and stuff?
Probably. I think Corey did the math on this, co-founder of Swan, and said something to the effect of like, you know, if let's say, you know, in the next cycle, people come in, there's going to be a lot more people coming in and maybe less of them will get caught up in the scams. But because of the amount of people coming in, I mean, look at where we are in Bitcoin. We're so early. If the next wave of people, 10 million people come in, 100 million people come in, what percentage of those get caught up in scams? And just do the math. It just, it doesn't look good. Whenever there's money, people are going to scam. I think that's the incentives are there to create your own coins, and it's easy to do. So if it's easy and the incentives are there, then people are going to do it. So I don't think, you know, how many coins are on CoinMarketCap? Like 5,000 now? I remember when I started, it was like, I think it was less than 1,000. In 2016, it was definitely less than 1,000. Maybe it was hundreds. And now it's 5,000. So do I think that number is going to go down? No. Why would it? People... Again, you're a developer sitting like in a basement somewhere and you can copy and paste Bitcoin and change a variable and launch a coin. Even if it makes you $100, it's worth doing.
Yeah.
People are going to do it.
It costs you nothing. And at the same time, it's like why is it that the second, the third hype cycle or whatever that people would come in knowing the fundamentals, you know, like I wouldn't have the same misinterpretation as, you know, everybody else that came into this.
I think what is promising to some degree is that in the media, like most of the time they're talking about Bitcoin, right? They're not really talking about other coins. And especially in the more legitimate circles, we're talking about people like in the financial media, in the, you know, the hedge funds, the big time investors, they're not coming out like Paul Tudor Jones isn't out there investing in Doge, right? Or even Ethereum, right? He's out there talking about Bitcoin. So I think that helps people to have a frame of reference. Because honestly, if you ask most people on the street, they haven't heard of any of these altcoins. They don't know there's 5,000 coins. Mm-hmm. The reason they get sucked into that is that they buy their Bitcoin and then all of a sudden they buy it on Coinbase and the Coinbase shows them 30 other coins and says, hey, we'll teach you how to trade these. And that's how people fall down that rabbit hole. And that's bad. You know, hopefully, I don't think Coinbase is going to learn their lesson. They're listing, you know, horrible, like 2017 era shit coins right now. I won't even mention them by name. But like, why, you know, they've chosen that business model as a trading platform. And that's going to suck more people into these other scams. And that's unfortunate, but that's life. You know, people are going to trade. People trade penny stocks too. I don't know if it's that different. You know, there's a lot of penny stocks that are either outright scams or completely failed companies that people just literally pump and dump. So, you know, is that behavior going to stop?
Such is life.
People like to gamble. Yeah, such is life.
It's part of the maturing process too. Like so many of us, you know, sometimes like that's just how people learn, you know, like that's how, like for the barrier, I mean, the learning curve is huge, you know?
That's how I learned. Look, I traded horrible, you know, shit coins back in the day. And I got into the space, and then I was like, oh, this is, you know, people gamble on this. This is great. Like, I think I can predict the next project that's going to pump.
Tempting.
It's so tempting. It's so tempting. And it's just like stock trading, right? Like you can kind of trade stocks and, you know, try to make some bets, or you can just hold and invest and not worry about it. And I think over time, as you mature, you start to become more like, you know, this is the thing I believe in. I'm going to buy some of this and I'm going to sit on it. I'm going to keep buying more of it. And when it gets cheap. And that's what I do with Bitcoin now.
What triggered you to write the book exactly? Like you said, like you were, you know, talking at high schools and stuff like that. Was there anything in particular? I mean, was it the money aspect or?
Not making money, that's for sure, because
that was a joke about how
hard it is to make money writing books. Do you guys think I got rich off of inventing Bitcoin? The reason I wrote the book really was I did want to give people something that they could read, but I actually looked at what I could recommend, and there was Mastering Bitcoin by Andreas, which is like 300 or 400 pages. It's very technical, a lot of programming stuff in there. There wasn't a ton of stuff at the time. There was a few books that were general, high level, like The Book of Satoshi, which is kind of cool. It has a bunch of Satoshi quotes in it. But I didn't find anything at the time that was short and accessible. And I think that at the end of the day, I felt like I could do that. I could write something that was short, accessible, and still got to the meat of what Bitcoin is and how it works. Because for me, when I got into Bitcoin, I wish that I could read something that just explained to me like why. Is it true that there are only 21 million Bitcoins? Why is it true that mining, you know, is on this predictable schedule that nobody can alter? And those things are not simple questions to answer. And in order to understand them, you have to walk through the process of like how Bitcoin works. And to me, I think the process of coming up with how a system is designed, this is kind of how I think, right? I'm an engineer. When I think of a system, I think, okay, how would I build this thing? So when I looked at Bitcoin, for a long time, I never actually read the white paper. I watched a bunch of videos. I watched like videos of Andreas explaining how mining works. And I got the concept of it. And I had a really good mental model in my head around how it worked before I even looked at the white paper. Then when I read the white paper, I was like just validating the ideas in my head that I already had constructed. So when it came time to write the book, I really wanted to have an approach that was kind of an engineering approach where how would I build this thing if I was Satoshi? You know, here are my motivations. So I looked at what Satoshi said in his forum posts, why did he want to create Bitcoin? You know, some of the issues around monetary debasement, privacy, like all these other things. And how would I build a system like that? And then I started looking at what are the problems that he had to solve. So that's really how I wanted to write it, because I didn't think anybody else tackled it in that way. And I think that walking through it that way helps people really create that mental model for themselves. So not only do they understand how Bitcoin works, but they can explain it to somebody else. You know, if somebody asks them, well, how do they prevent, you know, somebody from cheating? And they can talk about proof of work, and they can talk about nodes validating miners. They can think of these things because they have a mental model. So that's how I built the book, is around building that model in your head as you're inventing Bitcoin, kind of following that journey.
Well, you did an awesome job, and particularly like kudos from engineering perspective is the fact that you're, CTO, like usually developers and like people who know it deep on a technical level are the worst at trying to explain it at just kind of a general, like theoretical level or that the normie can understand.
Yeah.
but I'm actually trying to get my dad to listen to inventing Bitcoin. Nice. Just because I think it would be great for him to really dig into it. I think you'd grasp it. It really doesn't get, I mean, the outside of, you know, maybe explaining a hash or something.
Yeah, that's the part where it's really challenging not to get into weeds at all. But like, I tried to keep it still pretty high level. And, you know, there are some things that people will say, if you're like really pedantic, you'll say, well, this is not really true. It's not 100% true. But again, I'm trying to give people a mental model. I'm not going to get in there and explain the math of a hash or, you know, any of that stuff. It doesn't make any sense for normal people. They need to understand the concept that you take a bunch of garbage and you jumble it together and you get some other garbage out. That's what I hash it. Like it's just, you know, some data that gets jumbled together. So
I did a great job though. I'm excited. I've been trying to shill it to everybody who is slowly finding all the people in my other family and friends circle who are starting to go down the rabbit hole or getting intrigued by it. I'm like, dude, listen to Inventing Bitcoin. I still got a couple free copies. Let me shoot you one.
Yeah, great. And thank you for doing the narration. It's so clear. I think the way that you speak, I know, and it really drives the points home to people, because it is really a book that you want to read slowly. And I know that some of my friends that I've given it to, they're like, it's only 100 pages, but they'll read like 5 pages and digest it, you know?
Yeah.
Because it could be a lot in just a small amount of space.
Yeah, just the logic of it is in depth, you know? Like Bitcoin is such a complex, like interactive system. It's so, it just, God, it fascinates me.
Yeah, like, it's complex, but it's also elegant in its design. And a lot of people bring up the point of Bitcoin being complex, like it's a problem, and as if money isn't complex in general, as if our financial system isn't complex. I mean, you know, it's extremely complex, actually. What they really mean that it's complicated, like it's hard to understand, but it's not complex. And I don't know if I'm using these words right. There's a difference between complex and complicated. One of them is about how entangled things are. And so with the modern financial system, things are very, very entangled. So it seems simple that you have a dollar in your wallet or you have a dollar in your bank account that's digital and you know how to use it, you know how to send it to people. That's simple. Mm-hmm. It's like you understand how to use it. But actually, the underpinnings of that are incredibly complex and incredibly interwoven. And there's so many different layers and there's so many different players. And they're all interacting in ways that are completely subtle and to the point where literally nobody can explain to you how the whole thing works. Everybody has a different take on how does money actually work? You know, who creates money? Where does it come from? Where is it issued? There are smart people every day debating this stuff. And with Bitcoin,
contradictory at certain levels, you know, like it doesn't flow in any kind of extreme.
The modern financial system is circular. It's not linear. It's not like this thing produces this thing produces this thing. It's not how it works. All things flow into each other. So, you know, with Bitcoin, it's so much simpler. There's miners, there's users, there's nodes, and there's some code that ties it all together. It's not that complicated in that sense. Like everything is very clear. The emergent behavior of it is very interesting. It creates this notion of digital scarcity, but the pieces are simple in and of themselves. It's just how they're designed so elegantly to keep each other in check. That's really making the whole thing work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's endless, like exploring it and especially when you start getting into the impact of some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that got you? What led to Swan Bitcoin? What is it that, you know, you and Corey, did you know Corey beforehand? Did y'all just kind of meet up at some point?
Yeah, I can't actually trace when I first met Corey. I met him online in some Telegram chats. Corey is like a master Telegram organizer. He's got so many different Telegram rooms.
Dude, he is.
He really is. He's like a networking beast. And he knows all the people. And I met him randomly. And then I kind of started advising him on Give Bitcoin, which was his project at the time. And I was involved in that pretty early on, maybe from the beginning or from very early, helping a little bit on the education side, helping a little bit on the tech side. And then as that progressed, Corey and I got to know each other a little bit better because we actually ended up as advisors together to a different company called Riot, which is a public company, Riot Blockchain. Even though the word blockchain's in the name, don't be fooled. It's actually a Bitcoin mining company. But Riot,
that's just for selling.
Riot tried to help, like, brought on a bunch of Bitcoiners, me and him and Pierre Rochard, to like help them with Bitcoin strategy. And we got to know each other, and both of us had come to the same conclusion, which is that, you know, he had built Give Bitcoin because he wanted a way to onboard more Bitcoiners. And I was thinking about that too, because I was looking at, you know, when I left Reverb, I wanted to figure out what I was going to do, and I wrote the book. But at the end of the day, I wasn't sure that I wanted to start another company. But it became pretty obvious that the space for on-ramping people into Bitcoin had become, it was basically abandoned. Like Coinbase has voluntarily given that up. They were a great Bitcoin on-ramp in 2013. That's how I got into to Bitcoin in 2013. I downloaded the app and there was a buy Bitcoin button, and it was really easy. They gave that up to become a trading platform. So Kraken gave that up to become a trading platform. Every company in the space that was ever some kind of on-ramp is now a trading platform. So, and I can understand why. It's very lucrative, right? There's a lot of money mm-hmm. to be made in trading. These companies have billion-dollar valuations, and that's their choice. But I can't send my friends there. I can't send my mom there. I can't send anybody to a place where they're going to be encouraged to become day traders of crypto. And I use the word crypto in quotes, but, you know, it's... Most of the stuff has no fundamental value. So you don't want to send people to that kind of place. So I basically was thinking about where we are in the Bitcoin cycle, where, you know, the media thinks that we're going to the moon or we're going to zero. But the reality is that Bitcoin is very, very new and it's not widely distributed. And when you think about it as a money, it makes sense that only 10 years in, it's very early for a money. I mean, imagine you discovered gold. You're 10 years into the discovery of gold and like, all the pundits are like, why isn't gold adopted worldwide? And you're like, you're sitting there mining your gold and you're like, one day this will be worth something. You guys don't understand. This is scarce and people want it and it's durable and it's fungible. And like, you understand what the value of this thing is, but nobody around you does, right? Yeah. And when you see that same thing with Bitcoin and you understand that like, we are at ground zero, just 10 years into the discovery of a new money that's digital, people aren't even ready for digital money to begin with. They don't understand that the shift of digital money has already happened. That it's happening underneath their feet. They don't get it. And all of a sudden you have this new thing, which is open source and, you know, truly scarce. So that's where we are. We're so early. So what do you, kind of business do you want to build when it's, we're so early? You want to build a business that gets more people into it. At the end of the day, you don't want to be building application layer businesses. Again, I think they're important. Lightning Network is important. BTC's pay server is important. Zap's important. These are cool projects, but it's early. It's so early. If nobody has any coins, what's the good of, you know, spending them? So yeah, it's obvious to me that on-ramps are where it's at. You want to build an on-ramp, get more people into Bitcoin. And Corey and I basically had that same realization around the same time. And we started talking more and more and give Bitcoin morphed into Swan, which is, you know, this rebirth of something that is a much bigger play to really onboard the next, you know, million, 10 million, 100 million Bitcoiners.
Yeah. It seems like that's kind of a ballsy move. Like, from my perspective, is it like, you know, it seemed like it would be an uphill battle. Like, I think most people would have, I mean, did people tell y'all that it's like, Coinbase has it? Like, why are y'all doing that?
Yeah, like, every VC is like, Coin, why would you compete with Coinbase? But how many stock brokerages are there? How many gold brokerages are there? Like, and, you know, this, the space is so huge. I mean, we're talking about, if Bitcoin's actually the next global money, then billions of people have to be onboarded into it. Yeah. Not millions, billions. So the space to take these people is absolutely enormous. And the structure of these other companies that are competing in the space is totally different. I mean, Coinbase, Kraken, they all have hundreds of employees. They're very, very heavy on support because they have to support, you know, these other altcoins. We don't want any of that stuff. We're going to shed all that noise and all that weight and be a very lightweight company that only onboards Bitcoiners. And it's such a different product when you are committed to the core. Like, we are not going to become Coinbase. 100%. Yeah. I will walk away from Swan the day we list some other coin. It will never happen.
Okay. You're not going to put Cardano on there?
Never. Never. You're not getting your Cardano. You're not getting your Ethereum here. You're not getting any other crap. You're getting Bitcoin because we're creating people. We're giving people a future. You know, we're giving them money for their future that they need to be saving on a regular basis. And you know, that's what we're here for. So the space is wide open. The fact that other people don't see it, that's fine. People don't see Bitcoin in general. People think Bitcoin's a joke. It's still not getting into public consciousness. It's leaking in slowly, but it's going to take time. And during that time, we're going to fly under the radar and we're going to build the best on-ramp in the world.
Well, with that, give me your shill for Swan. why exactly? What's your elevator pitch for Swan versus any of the alternatives?
Well, Swan is just the best way to buy the best money in the world. It's that simple. You connect your bank account. We withdraw automatically from your bank. We buy automatically for you, and we automatically deliver it to your own custody if you want. Now, it's important to understand that a lot of hardcore Bitcoiners believe not your keys, not your coins. I believe that too. And I, of course, have my own custody over my own coins. But at the same time, we have to recognize that people like my mom or my friends are coming on board are not necessarily going to set up a wallet on day one. They don't necessarily understand it or are comfortable with it. So we believe that we have to pair that experience with really good education. So that means having people like Brady Swenson on board as host of Citizen Bitcoin, and, you know, having people like Stefan Lavera advise us, Matt Odell, people who believe in educating Bitcoiners the right way to help us shape that education. Because Swan is not just a platform for buying Bitcoin. It's a platform for learning about Bitcoin. And we're going to have email campaigns to help people do that. We have blog articles. We have the Swan Signal podcast and live show on Twitter every week. And these things are ways to
Y'all been killing Swan Signal lately. Thank you. I've been really loving it.
We've gotten some awesome guests. It's all about the guests. And my hat's off to the team that books these guys. But, you know, this is just the way that we get people to really understand Bitcoin, not just buy a number. Because a lot of people bought a number on Coinbase. This is the majority of people who own Bitcoin, the vast majority, they just have a number on Coinbase. Yeah. And that's not how we're going to have how Bitcoin's going to win. It's going to win when people understand the purpose of self-custody, understand how to take custody. These things require education, and they're not going to be overnight. So that's why we do work with a custodian, and we have your coins safe in cold storage until we can educate you on what kind of wallet to buy. Or to install, and how to get your coins off.
What do you see as the like, let's look two epochs or epics out. Like, what do you think the most important pieces are going to be over the next 8 years in this system? Like, the most important and maybe services like Swan Bitcoin, Lightning Network, like where do you think?
So obviously on ramps, I wouldn't be here if that wasn't the case. Yeah. I do think, of course, we're going to continue to on-ramp more people. I also think that we are at the dawn of the renaissance in wallets. I think that it's still early in wallets and we're going to see a lot of really cool wallet solutions. And I'd like to get to the point where people have an automagic Apple-like experience with setting up wallets that are multi-sig, that are just, you know, everything's just done for you. You don't have to worry about backups. You don't have to worry about how the multi-sig works. Everything just works for you and there's open source stuff to back it up. I'm very excited about stuff coming out of Unchained Capital, as well as, disclaimer, I'm an investor, and also Casa. These are companies that are looking at multi-sig solutions because they recognize that it's tough to set up a wallet to back up the seed, not lose it, not have it stolen, deal with inheritance planning. There's so many angles to this. If we really believe that Bitcoin is something for the next 10, 20, 25, you know, 50 years, we need to be thinking about it in long-term ways. And that means developing really good solutions for people to be able to take custody. And that's where I think the majority of the work will be, honestly, is really improving the user experience of wallets and how people get on-ramped straight from buying Bitcoin, getting it into their wallet, and then hopefully introducing additional privacy things in there. Maybe coin joins are happening automatically or whatever the next iteration of that technology is. I think that stuff is important. And I'm hoping that we'll see a lot more on that front as well.
Hell yeah. Yeah, actually, I just had a, which I haven't posted any of it yet. I should probably do this, post it as an episode, but I had a good conversation setting up my vault at Unchained with Phil.
Nice.
So I did, which was actually really fun because I hadn't used, like I've got so many freaking hardware wallets now, but it's really cool to like not even think about them as like my Bitcoin are on this, but that like I plug them in real quick, sign, like, and then I just kind of have, like, if I get two of them, I've got my Bitcoin, you know, like they're signing tools rather than like the place that my Bitcoin exists. Like actually
that's a very difficult mental model to break because a lot of people don't understand where their Bitcoin is located and they do think it lives on a wallet. And it's definitely something that we need to address with education as well as better user experiences.
Yeah. With that, is there anything, what's in the pipeline for Swan? I know there's like some stuff coming out soon.
It's a lot of stuff. So we're still finishing up a few things with auto withdrawals. So we plan to have XPub support pretty soon. We're going to have wire support so you can wire in your money. Right now with Swan, when you ACH in money, we have to hold it for an ACH fraud period, unfortunately, mandated by the bank. It's 10 days. So we're going to have wire transfers so that people can actually wire in money if they want to have a balance on Swan so they can buy more instantly. And, you know, some of those things, one-time buys, we're going to couple that with the wires. And lots more to come on our referral program, which just launched as well.
Yes.
Those of you who don't know, we have a new program called Swan Force. You can go to swanbitcoin.com/enlist if you want to be a part of the Swan Force and basically be out there shilling Bitcoin, helping people buy Bitcoin on Swan and get your own custom URL. If you're somebody who has a decent following and you want to drive some folks to the homepage, you can get your own URL. So for example, go to swanbitcoin.com/Jan. You'll see my beautiful face smiling at you. And a quote, and you can get that if you enlist in the Swan Force and drive some traffic and earn some sats for yourself as well. So we're in kind of deep in development on that and hope to roll out some dashboards to people pretty soon.
Nice. Awesome. All right. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I know you are a busy man. And anything else, any last words, final thoughts on Bitcoin and our future, anything
just
like that?
Keep stacking. Always be stacking, you know? Don't believe the hype. Always be stacking. That's my final word.
I am all the time. And that's because I have Swan Bitcoin. I don't have to do anything. I just
Swan,
am.
You heard it here, guys. Swan stacks on Swan.
cool,
thank
man.
You. Thanks for having me on, guys. It was a great conversation.
Dude, yeah, man.
And
appreciate it, Jan.
And again, thank you for doing the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Hit me up if you need anything. We'll talk later, man.
Bye.
Later.
And there we have it. Jan Pritzker, everybody. One last thank you to him for coming on the show. This was a really great conversation. And it's amazing how knowledgeable this guy is. If you are not following him on Twitter and keeping up with the work that he and the rest of the team at Swan Bitcoin are doing and, you know, their works in this space, if you haven't listened or read Inventing Bitcoin, you got to do it. It really is just great. And it does such a wonderful job of breaking down the logic behind the architecture without getting too deep into the weeds. And like I said, I'm going to be pushing it onto my dad to get him to listen to it. And if you're interested in that and you want that big picture view of Bitcoin, highly, highly recommended. So I'll have the links to all of that in the show notes so you can follow him on Twitter. You can check out swanbitcoin.com/guy. Obviously, go to my page. I am enlisted in the Swan Force. And I'll catch you next time. This has been a wonderful chat. I'm Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, take it easy, guys.